headlines, Iran says the United States is responsible for the grim situation Afghanistan is facing and the suffering its people are enduring. A former U.S. official says the administration of ex-President Donald Trump tried to play down American troops' injuries in an Iranian missile attack on a U.S. base in Iraq. And France says it will not accept Britain's, quote, financial blackmail as London steps up efforts to prevent migrants crossing the channel to reach Britain. Hello and welcome everybody here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Iran's foreign minister says the United States is responsible for the current dire situation and the suffering of the people in Afghanistan. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a meeting with his Qatari counterpart in Tehran. The top diplomats discussed a host of issues, including the recent developments in Afghanistan. During the meeting, Amir Abdullahian stressed the need for the formation of a broad-based government as the only way to restore stability to the war-weary nation. The official also reiterated Tehran's support of an Afghan government that includes all factions. In a later tweet, Qatari Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani highlighted the effectiveness of having a unified vision to ensure a comprehensive solution for Afghanistan. About 200 foreign nationals, including Americans, have flied out of Afghanistan in the first airlift since a U.S.-led evacuation operation ended on August the 30th. Qatar, which has helped open the airport in Kabul, said the first international commercial flight since U.S. withdrawal has departed Kabul. It said the airport has been tested and operationalized in the past few days. This comes after the Taliban's newly announced government agreed to the departure. The group's takeover of Afghanistan last month triggered the chaotic U.S.-led evacuation of 124,000 Afghans and foreigners from Kabul Airport. The facility was inactive after the operation. And the Taliban accused Washington of violating their peace deal by retaining the group's interior minister on the U.S. terror list. The group said keeping the cabinet members of the Haqqani family on the list is a clear violation of the 2020 agreement. This comes after the Pentagon said the Haqqani are still legitimate targets and remain on U.S. blacklists. The new minister is accused of involvement in attacks on U.S. forces during Washington's two-decade war in Afghanistan. In the wake of the 2020 deal with the Taliban, the United States had reportedly pledged to remove the group's members from the list of international sanctions. The deal paved the way for the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces last month. Elsewhere, a former U.S. official says the White House tried to downplay and delay reports of injuries American troops suffered in Iran's last year missile strike. The revelation was made by Alyssa Farah, an advisor to former President Donald Trump. She said Washington wanted to make the Iranian attack look unsuccessful while U.S. troops had suffered, quote, very significant injuries. In January last year, Iran fired a number of ballistic missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base hosting American soldiers. The strike was conducted in retaliation for the U.S. assassination of top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani. The White House initially claimed there had been no casualties among his forces. However, it later conceded that over 100 soldiers had suffered traumatic brain injuries. Iran says that it will continue to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to conduct safeguards inspections of the country's nuclear sites. A spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, however, said that Tehran will no longer permit IAEA inspections beyond the safeguards agreement. Behrouz Kamavandi described the decision as a response to the U.S. refusal to remove its anti-Iran sanctions. Late last year, Iran's parliament passed a resolution blocking foreign inspectors' unannounced access to the country's nuclear facilities. A motion followed the failure of the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to guarantee Iran's interests under the accord. Now, Tehran warns the IAEA against disrupting talks aimed at reviving the deal, also known as the JCPOA.
The IAEA cannot dissociate itself from the destiny of the JCPOA. Any counterproductive action disrupts the negotiation process. Of course, I hope that wisdom prevails in the Board of Governors next week. Cooperation for cooperation, goodwill for goodwill, action for action.
Qasem Gharibabadi said the IAEA has a duty to be impartial, professional, and independent. He also called on the agency to seek increased cooperation among its member states instead of sowing mistrust. Earlier, the Iranian president made similar remarks. Ebrahim Raisi warned the IAEA that its, quote, unconstructive attitude towards Iran could disrupt the course of JCPOA revival talks. He noted that Tehran's cooperation with the agency proves its transparency. Raisi also said his country was the only party that honored its commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, despite the other signatories' failure to fulfill their obligations. The JCPOA has been in disarray following Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. Elsewhere, Paris has warned London against, quote, financial blackmail as Britain steps up efforts to prevent migrants from crossing the English Channel from France. The French Interior Minister said his country will not accept the practice, which he described as a violation of international maritime law. Gerald Darmanin stressed, rather, that Britain's commitments to the issue of illegal migrants must be respected. This came after Britain announced plans to begin turning back migrants' boats before crossing into UK waters. Back in July, Britain had pledged financial assistance to help France stem the flow of illegal immigrants. However, London has reportedly said that it may withhold the money. Our Paris-based correspondent Chris Denhon says neither France nor the United Kingdom is willing to take responsibility for migrants crossing the English Channel.
The last months have been observed a record of migrants taking boats, small and medium-sized boats, from France to the UK. And the international maritime law stipulates that if these boats arrive in the territorial waters of the UK is obliged to save the human life and to keep those people in a security. Now the UK is doing everything to interpret this maritime law on another level. They say we only have to do this with big boats, and when there isn't like a big huge accident, then they have to intervene, not with small boats. So they want to send back these boats to France. Now France, the Darmanin minister, interior minister, he says that he is basing on this international maritime law, obliging the UK to keep the migrants in the UK. Now, Darmanin is not doing this with the humanitarian feelings, because he himself is a known anti-migrant and a racist minister in the past and in the present. He is doing this because France prefers not to receive these migrants back in France.
A Palestinian official warns Israel of major unrest if any of the six prisoners who escaped this week is killed during the regime's manhunt. The governor of the West Bank city of Jenin said, if the lives of the inmates are harmed, the situation will be very bad. He added that Ramallah won't cooperate with Israel to locate and capture the prisoners. Meanwhile, Israel has canceled family visits for all Palestinian inmates this month as a collective punishment following the prison break. The prisoners fled one of Israel's highest security jails on Monday through a hole reportedly dug with a spoon. The Syrian army has taken control of a strategic area in the southwestern city of Daraa under a Russian-brokered ceasefire deal with the militants there. Under the terms of the deal, militants must either leave the area or hand over their firearms if they choose to remain. Earlier, Muhammad Ali joined us with more details.
Yes, I am now inside the Daraa Governorate in southern Syria. I am exactly standing at the entrance of Daraa al-Balad, the area that the Syrian army entered and took control of just 2 days ago following a deal reached with the armed groups inside this quarter. Now, there are thousands of people, civilians, residents, who left Daraa al-Balad about 2 weeks ago when the negotiations failed. They were fearing of the battles that could have could happen inside. So those civilians left 2 weeks ago, and the Syrian government welcomed them in temporary shelters until this deal is reached. Now that the deal is reached, now that security is restored inside and that the armed men have surrendered their weapons and they have reconciled with the Syrian government, the civilians now are going back home. The recent developments with regards to this deal is that the Syrian army has established several security checkpoints to ensure security and stability in the future inside Daraa al-Balad.
Yemen's health officials say at least 100 health facilities have stopped offering services due to fuel shortage. They blame the shortage on Saudi Arabia, saying the kingdom's imposed siege on the impoverished nation has hampered daily life in Yemen. Abdullatif al-Mushami has more in this report.
The healthcare system in Yemen is deteriorating due to the ongoing Saudi blockade that has led to a harsh shortage of fuel. Sana'a Health Bureau said 100 health facilities had to stop providing health services partially or completely due to their inability to generate power anymore.
The fuel cuts in our country due to the blockade and aggression have affected the ability of health facilities to provide the necessary health services to our people. Our hospital has been negatively affected so that we have no way but to increase the charge of our services, and this constitutes an additional burden on Yemenis, especially amid the war and siege.
A civilian maternal hospital in Yemen's capital Sana'a used to have 45,000 liters of diesel each month as a grant from the World Health Organization. However, the world body, the hospital said, has stopped its fuel grant due to what it says, financial problems.
We are Sab'een Hospital in Sana'a. It is the referral hospital for maternity and the childhood disease. We are before we received oil from the WHO during 2021. The amount of the oil received to the hospital is become decreased to the fourth. The amount already we receive it. It is big catastrophe. It will lead to the death of the many child and woman, especially that admitted in the ICU, in the nursery, and the OT. Here in the hospital, we decrease most of our services to decrease the use of the electricity.
Earlier, Yemen's petroleum company said only three oil ships were allowed to arrive at Hudaydah port since the beginning of 2021, covering only 3% of what is required to fulfill the basic needs of Yemenis. The Saudi war and the blockade have led Yemen to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Yemen's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse as a result of the Islamic Saudi war and the blockade. Yemen has also blamed the United Nations for their suffering, saying the world body should take real measures against the continued Saudi violations of their rights. Abdullatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on Britain, with the country reporting 167 new daily fatalities. UK health officials also logged over 38,000 new infections. The country has so far registered more than 7 million cases and over 133,500 fatalities. The UK has been reporting a steady increase in deaths among COVID patients since lockdowns were lifted in mid-July. However, the fatalities are still lower than in previous waves of the pandemic. Nearly two-thirds of the British population has been fully vaccinated. Japan has extended emergency COVID-19 prevention restrictions in the capital, Tokyo, and some other regions until the end of this month. The move is aimed at containing infections and preventing hospitals from being overwhelmed. Japan has been struggling with the fifth wave of the virus. Last month, the country extended its long-running curbs until the 12th of September to cover about 80% of its population. However, the number of severe cases and the strain on the medical system has not eased sufficiently in Tokyo and its surrounding areas. Nevertheless, there are some signs of improvement around the nation. Two prefectures out of 21 will move from the state of emergency to more targeted restrictions. A number of other prefectures will also remove all curbs. China has slammed the United States for sailing a warship through the South China Sea, calling it a violation of its sovereignty and security. In a statement, the Chinese military called the move illegal and ironclad evidence of Washington's hegemony and militarization of the strategic waters. The U.S. dismissed the accusations by calling them false and excessive. The U.S.-guided missile destroyer USS Benfold sailed near the Spratly Islands on Wednesday, just a few days after China imposed new identification rules that apply to the disputed body of water. China claims the South China Sea in its entirety. However, some of its neighbors have also overlapping claims, and the U.S. sides with Beijing's rivals in this dispute. Author and columnist Inner Tangen says there is an inescapable irony regarding the U.S. moves and policies in the South China Sea.
Beijing is losing patience. There does not seem to be a constructive dialogue. This idea that the U.S. is there to protect a treaty, UNCLOS, which is not a part of, deliberately would not sign it because they would not adhere to the idea that there could be any impingement on its sovereignty, is now insisting that it has the right to impose UNCLOS on other sovereign nations. The irony is inescapable, but it has not stopped the U.S., which continues to try to provoke this. There's some feeling that they are trying to keep tensions on a knife edge without going over. This type of kind of gumboat diplomacy is fraught with danger. China's had 40 years of success. During that same 40-year period, the U.S. has gone sideways in so many ways, in some ways backwards, in terms of social policies, African-Americans, civil rights, and now even voting. So at this juncture, China's success is an existential threat to the U.S. because the U.S. believes that there is only one way of governance. It is a liberal, democratic capitalism.
Well, that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Health tourism. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the 8th episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce you a well-known hospital in Tehran, the Jam Hospital, and also the Bina Hospital, a well-known specialist eye ophthalmology hospital in the Iranian city of Mashhad, which is active in the International Patient Admission, or IPD, department. Please stay with us. Mashhad, the capital of Khorasan Razavi province, is the second largest city in Iran. The holy shrine of the 8th Shia Imam, Imam Reza, peace upon him, who is highly esteemed by Muslims, is also located in this city. For this reason, Mashhad is called the spiritual capital of Iran. The presence of the shrine of Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza, peace upon him, and many spectacular historical and recreational attractions has made this city one of the tourist hubs of Iran that annually receives thousands of pilgrims and tourists from all over Iran and the world. The shrine of Imam Reza, peace upon him, is located in the center of Mashhad. Some of the structures of this holy shrine date back before the Safavid dynasty and from the Timurid period, and even before that. But during the reign of Shah Tahmasp Safavid, many activities were carried out to expand the shrine. Therefore, this holy place is considered a large museum of Iranian architecture. In addition to being a pilgrimage city, Mashhad also benefits from many tourist attractions. One of these attractions is Mashhad Stone Mountain Park, which is very old and famous and is one of the most beautiful parks in Iran. This park is a combination of water, stone, greenery, and light. Other historical and scenic places in Mashhad include Malik Historical House, National Garden, Vakilabad Park, Haft Hoz Natural Park, St. Mesrop Church, and the tomb of Nader Shah Afshar. The city of Mashhad, with 2,226 accommodation units and dozens of direct flights to various destinations, is one of the tourism hubs of Iran. This, along with well-equipped hospitals and competent doctors, has attracted thousands of health tourists both from home and abroad to this city. They travel to Mashhad for treatment of various diseases and benefit from its excellent medical facilities. The city is historic, scenic, safe, and well worth a visit. In the remainder of this program, we will introduce you a specialist medical facility in the city of Mashhad, the Bina Eye Hospital, and we will become more familiar with the medical services and facilities offered and its IPD department. Stay with us. Bina Ophthalmology Hospital, with 7 floors, with a base of 9,500 square meters, was inaugurated on September 23, 2018. The hospital has 32 beds, 6 operating rooms, 2 laser operating rooms, and a specialized ophthalmology services. Bina Eye Hospital also has 19 inpatient rooms, of which 5 are single rooms and 14 are double rooms. In this medical center, 6 operating rooms with nano equipment and ophthalmology devices with the latest technology in the world for corneal diseases, cataract, and other eye diseases have been provided. Bina Hospital has made to utilize the experienced ophthalmologists and in order to cure diseases related to the cornea, retina, glaucoma, strabismus and eye aberrations, eye surface diseases, different types of eye and tear duct allergies, DCR, cosmetic eye surgeries, and neuro-ophthalmology, and in other words, all eye diseases, so that the patient does not need to go to other medical centers. One of the departments of Bina Eye Hospital is the International Relations Unit. This unit has been established in order to provide services and increase the satisfaction of foreign patients and their well-being. Due to the high quality of medical services, the low cost of treatment, state-of-the-art equipment, and up-to-date world-class ophthalmologists and physicians, many medical tourists come to this hospital for treatment. These tourists are mostly from Iran's neighboring countries, such as Tajikistan, Republic of Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Iraq, Pakistan, and even some European countries such as Sweden and Germany. The International Patients Unit of the Eye Hospital manages and facilitates all matters related to the treatment of foreign patients before the patient enters Iran until they're discharged from the hospital. The IPD team of the Eye Hospital is composed of international patient experts, English and Arabic translators, experienced doctors and nurses, and provides the best facilities to patients so that the patient has complete satisfaction during his treatment in Iran. The patient or the health tourist can be admitted to the eye hospital either by going to the hospital in person, via phone or online, or refer to the facilitation companies. and obtain required information about the cost of treatment in the hospital. The city of Mashhad, with its competent physicians, committed medical staff, and up-to-date and modern equipment, has a large share in the Iranian health tourism industry. Of course, the presence of pilgrims has also been very effective in increasing the health tourism of this city. Bina Eye Hospital, which is a new and well-equipped hospital of its kind, has been very popular among foreign tourists, despite the short time that has passed since its establishment and operation. Dear friends, for more information about Bina Eye Hospital, you can visit the website of this hospital at www.ehbina.com or http://ehbina.com/pages/English homepage or call 0098-5136163 and get information on how to admit in this center. The hospital's email is info@ehbina.com, which is, of course, another way to contact Bina Hospital. Dear listeners, that was the 8th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
There's a particular way of remembering and commemorating Ashura that we need to learn from, and this will help us be able to remain on course, and without this, we are in danger. What is that? What it is hardships, difficulties. If they are seen as setbacks, sometimes I'll talk a little bit about this. If we see the other side, the enemies, seemingly winning something at some point, hurting us, going through something very serious, these don't even slow us down. This is what we learn from Imam Zainab al-Abidin and his companions, now Zainab and the women and the children at this point. It doesn't even slow them down. But to understand that, I need to remind us or maybe correct an impression that we have. Since when we remember Ashura and after Ashura, the family of the Imam, we remember what others did to them And that causes us to feel very sad and we cry. We neglect the fact that that's not the only thing that happened there. It wasn't only what they did to the Ahlul Bayt. What did the Ahlul Bayt do? If you only talk about what the others did to them, the mistreatment of the enemies regarding the Ahlul Bayt, and cry of that, which we should do that, but if we only do that, we may start thinking that that's the only thing that happened. So the Ahlul Bayt were just targets of all this treachery, this bad behavior, the tortures, the pains, and so on and so forth. The fact is, that's part of what happened. And it is horrible, and it should be remembered, and we should beat our chests, and we should cry about it. But we should also remember Imam Zain al-Abidin, salamullah alayhi, Zainab, salamullah alayhi, the others there, salamullah alayhim, all those are referred to in Ziyarat Ashura. When we refer to the Ashab, it's not only the Shuhada that are there. The Ashab of Imam al-Husayn include all those women and children there. So when we say that salam alaykum minni jami'an salamullah towards the beginning of Ziyarat Ashura, we are addressing all of them. Let's not forget that. We are addressing all of these women and children that are part of the Mujahideen, and their role predominantly starts after the day of Ashura. Imam Zainul Abidin has the task of continuing this jihad against the rulers, and he does. He now has the task of making sure that the blood of the Shuhada does not go to waste. They wanted to kill Imam al-Husayn and to make an example out of Imam al-Husayn, to show people that if you stand against Yazid, this is your destiny. And use all the scholars, all the religious rhetoric, everything available to them, the ashab of the Prophet that remained, to justify it Islamically, the combination of those becoming that the Umayyad Islam remains and is seen as the legitimate form of Islam. Anyone who disagrees, anyone who tries to say this is not Islam, this is not Islam of the Prophet, in the name of Islam, they will call him a Khariji, they will kill them, and they will hang their heads and bodies and say, this is Islam. This is Umayyad Islam. That was their agenda. So Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, in his courtyard, he gathers them. It's not enough we kill. No, bring the women. We want to show this as an example. Bring the heads here. And he says, look at what God did to your brother. God. We are the rulers. God has empowered us, using Islamic language, religious rhetoric. God destroyed your brother. Ali ibn Husayn, God destroyed your father. All the other stuff that they're now presenting. Imam Zain al-Abidin and the companions, it seems to me, my reading of that part of history, there's not too much, I think I mentioned this earlier on, I haven't seen at least too much talk from Imam Zain al-Abidin in the stages of Kufa, at least officially. Those are usually recorded. In the court of Yazid, there's not too much conversation. It seems, it looks as if he's still ill enough not to be able to have much of a presence. That's the way it looks, of course. His companions under his instructions, predominantly Zainab, salamullahi alayha. She is like the Abbas of this scene. The one who speaks. The one who speaks in the court of Yazid, in the streets of Kufa. Getting the message across to the people of Kufa, what you did was very shameful. Very wrong. This tawbah is not accepted. your cries are not accepted. To make sure that everybody here understands this was wrong, despite all the conversation, talks, speeches of whatever ruler, to make sure that feeling of resentment, that feeling of regret, that feeling of why did this happen, that feeling of these are the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet, that they knew. Zainab, with her talks to the people, made sure that remained, for them to identify this as a crime, so that the conversations, the talks, trying to present this as a good deed, does not remain in history. They consider it wrong. And then in the court of Ubaydullah, standing up against him, presenting that notion in his presence, which has an additional effect, that the ruler saying that in the face of the ruler, there's certain times Islam says talking to people, talking to some of those who may have been involved in a crime is not enough. You got to speak to the rulers, the leaders, directly, put them down. Zainab sallallahu alayhi wa sallam speaks to him. He puts him in his place. She puts him in his place with her responses and her talks, even with her tears. Even with her tears. And then the climax of this is in the courtyard of Yazid, because that's the head of it. That's the ruler. That's the person that you need to hit the hardest. And Imam Zain al-Abidin and Zainab salamullah alayha, with their words, and the children with their behavior, and the women with their behavior, with the way they conducted themselves, they hit Yazid the hardest in his courtyard.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. A heat dome without parallel trapped hot air over much of the states of Oregon and Washington in the United States and southern British Columbia in Canada in past days, shattering weather records in the usually temperate region. We're prepared for you an article written by Levi Paul Keenan. The piece is titled, Americans Thought It Wouldn't Affect Them, Heatwave Forces Climate Reckoning in Pacific Northwest. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The record heatwave in the Pacific Northwest is forcing a reckoning on the climate crisis, as many living in the typically mild region consider what rising temperatures mean for the future. A heat dome without parallel trapped hot air over much of the states of Oregon and Washington in the United States, and southern British Columbia in Canada in past days, shattering weather records in the usually temperate region. Temperatures in the tiny village of Lytton, British Columbia, hit 49.6 degrees Celsius, that is 121 degrees Fahrenheit, and set a Canadian all-time record just days before a wildfire tore through the town. Roads buckled under the heat in Washington and Oregon. Heat and heavy air conditioner use knocked out power for tens of thousands. The dead, thought to number in the hundreds, are not yet counted. In Washington and Oregon, largely liberal, climate-conscious states, efforts to combat global heating have long been purportedly popular. The Washington governor, Jay Inslee, put himself forward as the climate candidate during the 2020 Democratic presidential primary. He argued residents of the region would, in the absence of federal leadership, do our part to address a global problem. Climate conversations have generally centered on what Northwesterners could do to protect the planet or other people in places at greater risk of extreme heat. But after 3 days of temperatures nearer above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38 degrees Celsius in Seattle, a city which residents often describe the 6 months as January, as temperatures rarely reach 80 degrees Fahrenheit, they're increasingly concerned about themselves. Summer Stinson, a 49-year-old Seattle nonprofit executive, said it felt like we'd set our earth on fire. Stinson continued, "There was a naivety that this wouldn't affect us in the Northwest." Having lived in Las Vegas, Nevada, Stinson knew how to deal with the heat. She covered south-facing windows in her craftsman-style home with aluminium foil, kept the appliances off, and hunkered down with her teenage son. It was oppressive, evocative of the wildfire smoke that's kept West Coast residents trapped inside during recent summers. While city workers turned on some water fountains and spray parks, many wading pools remained closed because of a national chlorine shortage. Like most prosperous American cities, Seattle has hundreds of people living in tents and shanties in public parks and vacant spaces. In Stinson's view, city leaders should have opened more cooling centers and ensured that they stayed open through the hot nights. In the emergency department of Seattle's Harborview Medical Center, the region's premier trauma hospital, Dr. Jeremy Hess found the scene he expected on coming nights, dozens of people with heat-related ailments. By Monday evening, 5th of July, as the temperatures peaked, the scene was unusually intense. Ambulance teams were run ragged, transporting critically ill patients who'd been intubated in the field. One area hospital was low on ventilators, while equipment at others was breaking in the heat. Hospitals were nearly overwhelmed. Dr. Jeremy Hess, who also directs the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the University of Washington, said, "We really hadn't had activity like that since the beginning of the COVID outbreak here. We were on the edge. Having contributed to United Nations climate work, Dr. Jeremy Hess knew both the dangers posed by extreme heat and a lack of preparation in most communities, including his own. Dr. Hess said there had been a sense that the Northwest would be spared the worst harms presented by a warming world. There's truth to the sentiment inasmuch as the region, with its affluence, abundant resources, and usually mellow weather, is better positioned than much of the world for a hotter, more erratic climate. The deadly heat wave came as a surprise. He said people have recognized that this might happen in theory, but I don't think they expected it to happen here. He added, they certainly didn't expect it to happen now, and they didn't expect it to be this bad. As of Thursday, 1st of July, officials in Washington had attributed 20 deaths to the heat wave, 13 of them in King County, which includes Seattle. The state's medical examiner said Oregon had reached 79 deaths attributable to the heat, and officials in British Columbia, Canada, said they had recorded hundreds more sudden and unexpected deaths, though they cautioned it was too soon to determine how many were heat-related. All of those numbers are expected to rise in the coming days. The Washington State climatologist Nick Bond said directly to blame for the tragedy was a towering ridge of high-pressure air that cut off the flow of cool, wet wind from the Pacific Ocean. The ridge, dubbed the heat dome, also warmed the air by compressing it and funneled hot, dry air eastwards from the arid side of the Cascade Mountains. Climatologist Nick Bond described the phenomena as unprecedented. Crucially, from a health perspective, it held nighttime temperatures up, prolonging heat-related stress on residents. Was climate breakdown to blame? Nick Bond was equivocal. Normal daytime temperatures in the region have risen about 2 degrees Celsius, while normal nighttime temperatures are up about 3 degrees Celsius. Nick Bond said it stood to reason that the heat wave would have been less severe if the climate were generally cooler. More instructive, in Nick Bond's views, is the fragility revealed by the extreme heat. He said, there is no question the climate is warming, and this shows that what can happen. He added, we didn't like it, so let's do something about it. When Michaela Eaves and her colleagues heard the extreme heat was on the way, they put up tents, big ones with air conditioning, and filled them with animals. Michaela Eaves is a volunteer with Washington State Animal Response Team. She and other volunteers spent the scorching weekend cooling dogs, cats, and other pets housed inside military surplus tents set up southeast of Seattle. Dogs stayed in their own tent, while cats, kept company by a flock of chickens and a rabbit, stayed in the darkened enclosure. The shelter hit its maximum capacity of 40 animals each day before it closed on Tuesday, 29th of June. Dodging the heat wasn't an option for Cody Spencer, 32, or his wife. Together, they run a pair of video game stores in Seattle, catering to technology workers interested in spending some of their disposable income on vintage Nintendo systems. While one of the couple's stores has air conditioning, the other, located in Seattle's historic International District, does not. Cody Spencer said, it's really old building, super, super old, and so is the landlord, and he wasn't helping at all. Customers kept coming, so Spencer sweated out the hottest days in Seattle's history. Home was no better. Though he lives in a kind of spend-why apartment, Spencer, like most Seattleites, doesn't have air conditioning. Of course, air conditioning is a poor response to a warming world. Washington state lawmakers have taken more substantial action on climate change and recently created a cap-and-trade system similar to California's, as well as new rules meant to constrain transportation pollution. On Thursday, 1st of July, the Washington State Senator Rebecca Saldana, whose support proved crucial to passage of the cap-and-trade plan earlier in the year, said the heat wave demonstrated the need for climate action, particularly for people already living with pollution. Senator Rebecca Saldana believes a new racially aware anti-pollution effort in Washington may prove consequential. Senator Saldana, a progressive Democrat representing a racially and economically diverse Seattle district, said, "There is a way forward." She added, "I don't think the will is there yet, but I'm hopeful that these moments of crisis, these moments where our communities are being tested, will light a fire to do something."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein gave life and meaning to the day of Ashura. January 9th, 2010. All days of the year are essentially the same. It is human beings, their determination, and selfless efforts that make certain days prominent and turn them into a flag to guide other people. Ashura, the 10th of Muharram, is not in itself different from other days. It was Imam Hussein who gave life and meaning to that day and raised its position. It was the selfless efforts of Hussein ibn Ali's companions that made Ashura so important. How valuable are ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom? December 27th, 2009. Some people may question the value of the ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom. They may say, if you want to speak about Imam Hussein's movement, just go ahead and speak about his movement. Why all the crying? This is a wrong assumption. It will be extremely hard to move ahead on this path in the absence of this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. This sense of friendship is of paramount importance, and it can be achieved through this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. Narrating the tragedies that happened to them is an attempt to establish this emotional connection. Similarly, praising their virtues through the mourning ceremonies is another way to form this emotional bond. Therefore, it is necessary to hold the mourning ceremonies and narrate the events of Ashura.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لاتشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان أنا لات
Mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein's martyrdom are great opportunities to promote Islam. December 13, 2009. Religious publicity in the month of Muharram is a case in point. The religious ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom provide us with the best opportunity to promote Islam. We should utilize this opportunity in order to help distinguish right from wrong and create a beacon of guidance for the people. In the modern world, creating fitnas is the main technique that is used by the enemies of the truth. In such a situation, the proponents of the truth should provide the people with as much insight and clear guidance as they can so that they do not get confused.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.